Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Fallon Pike. We're joined today by Nick Pinsky. Nick is a principal engineer at AWS, where he works in the serverless group at the world's biggest cloud provider. Welcome, Nick. Glad to have you on the show.
Thanks, Fallon. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to dig in on some. We had a lot of folks that on the managerial track talking about how to, like, you know, manage people and, you know, motivate their teams. But I'm excited to dig in to talking about this, like, sort of staff plus engineering track, folks that are in the leadership, but not necessarily in the management side of things.
Totally. The soft kind of leadership is its own type of both curse, but also heaven in some times, depending on the day.
Yeah, I think all kinds of leadership are a mix of curse and heaven, depending on the day. So we'll dig into that. And also love to dig into also some of what makes AWS tick as an organization that almost all of us are probably familiar with in the way that it sort of powers a lot of our lives today. But first, I want to give you a chance to give us a little bit of context, kind of a soundbitey overview of how did you get to be a principal engineer at AWS? You probably didn't just, like, graduate high school and then, all right, here's the role. What did that path look like for you?
No, in fact, when I think about my earlier career, I actually think that I tell this openly to junior engineers who join. I don't think I would have been able to succeed at a company like Amazon, or really anywhere in kind of what, you know, we call big tech these days, when I was a junior engineer first coming out of either high school or university. I was kind of a little bit adrift at that time. I knew I liked technology. I knew I liked, you know, geeking out on code and building things, but I wasn't really sure if this was actually going to be the right thing for me. And it took me some time before I figured it out. Like you, I'm Vancouver-based software engineer. I went to UBC. I wasn't born in Vancouver, but my family immigrated to Canada when I was 10. So basically I'm from here. And when I first graduated UBC with a computer science degree, I really wasn't sure what I wanted out of a career or life. I guess probably pretty common. And I actually ended up just hanging around university for another year, taking classes and thinking about grad school, and ran out of money and got a job at it because my parents' friend was hiring, and it would end up being at the small Victoria-based foreign currency exchange. And eventually that actually ended up unlocking something in me. And what it was I really enjoyed the process of kind of how they converted, you know, business requirements to technology. And I found that was actually my passion more than specifically, you know, the latest frameworks or the latest whatever. I just really liked solving problems ultimately. And however, what that was, whether that meant building something or not building something, I just really liked the process of that. And that was sort of my first passion that I discovered, like just the collaborative experience of domain-driven design and coming up with a ubiquitous language for a problem. Like, I found that modeling a system, like, I found that stuff really interesting. And I kind of rose to ranks. That company was probably in the street for about 7 or 8 years before I realized I was just kind of getting bored and was seeking a new challenge. And that was around the same time that Amazon had just come to Vancouver. So that was 2013. And at that point, it was maybe, I was still in the first 100 employees, I think, in Vancouver. Now we have over 3,000 in Vancouver alone. What attracted me there was just that at that point I was like, well, yeah, like this cloud thing, what's that all about? And I hear they've got some pretty intense problems of scale. And it was very different than what I was doing in my career at that point, but it seemed like a good challenge. I joined as an intermediate engineer. And I got promoted twice. So first to a senior engineer and then to eventually to a principal engineer, which I guess some companies call that staff. And then they have another level beyond staff called principal. But so like in Google staff, and I think is comparable to an Amazon principal. There's always overlap. There's some senior staff. It's fuzzy, right? There's a lot of overlap between these.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a website called levels.fyi, which has a bunch of, like, you know, people will debate about how accurate the information on that website is. But what it's trying to do is trying to, like, create a little bit of a conversion cheat sheety thing where you're trying to understand, okay, well, I'm looking at this either a potential hire or a potential role, or trying to make sense of something that somebody said from this organization. And, like, let's say they're at Amazon and they're a principal engineer, and then this other person is at Apple and they're like ICT 6, And it's like, okay. Right. And they don't even have a name for it, right? It's like, well, which, like, are these people relatively similar in seniority, or is there a big difference here? And then there's orgs that, like you say, will do staff and then principal, or sometimes they'll go staff and senior staff and then principal. And then there's, like, in extreme cases, there's, like, distinguished engineers, which there might only be one in the entire organization and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think we have, like, 12 or something at Amazon. And, like, I think, like, more than half of them have Wikipedia pages. So,
yeah,
that's like, you know, while that is a sign of the path and towards them, I'm going, there's a senior principal beyond that, and then distinguished engineer. That's not really one I'm expecting to reach myself. The Wikipedia prerequisite is not written down anywhere, but I do think it helps.
Yeah, it's correlated, right?
Maybe a little.
You've invented something. I've seen before, actually, career ladders that explicitly say, like, if at this level, which is like what I'm distinguished engineer or whatever, like, you're likely to have invented something that is, like, meaningful industry-wide.
Right.
Which is, you know, a cool thing to aspire to, but it's not like, it's not one of those requirements. I think actually an interesting, and we can actually jump to this, was like on the topics I wanted to get to, but one of the things that I think folks that have not worked in big tech or like larger tech that has a kind of a formalized career ladder and rigorous thinking around this stuff might not be familiar with the term of a terminal level. Is that, do you use that terminology at Amazon?
Yeah, we do. Although I don't know if there's a gentler term for it.
It sounds bad, right?
Sounds bad, right? Yeah. Yeah. When I joined 10 years ago, the terminal level was senior, which is so kind of junior engineers, intermediate engineers, and senior engineers. So you had to get promoted twice. Now the terminal level got bumped down one, and I think it's happened across big tech that basically you can kind of need to get promoted once. But after that, in big tech, the intermediate engineer, like, used to be the role model for an intermediate engineer. And I'm not saying that just because that's how I got hired, was like, you were a senior engineer at a smaller company.
And now you're an intermediate engineer at a big
intermediate at a big company. And where things got interesting is that probably worked for most of the 2000s and maybe the 2010s. And then just in the last couple of years, in the quote-unquote great resignation, of course, this year is a little different, but last 2 years, there's just so many unicorns and kind of startups that could actually hire those folk and basically give them senior offers for more money and more responsibility. So it became really hard for big tech to actually kind of down-level the way that they historically have, where you basically take a person who's already probably not writing code. Like, I wasn't writing code when I started Amazon already. I was already a quote-unquote tech lead, you know, just doing code reviews and architectural design diagrams, not really writing code full-time, except very rarely. And I came in and suddenly it was my only job was to write code. And I was like, oh, this is actually kind of great. And I still love working with people like that who are sort of like overscaled for the job a little bit, like, because it, you know, it means you have good judgment and they can work autonomously and deliver a lot of great stuff. And if you can reach those people and saying, hey, that's the compelling value proposition for you to come over, it can be an amazing match in terms of like getting a lot of stuff done and high impact and a person who's really satisfied with their job.
Yeah.
But that's impossible to hire those people right now.
Yes. And especially it was a year ago. One thing, before we lose the thread, I want to sort of just put a cap on this idea of the terminal level, or there's probably nicer terms that some organizations call it. But when you're building out these advanced like career ladders, so it's not just like, okay, we have junior, intermediate, senior, but then giving, which is best practice now, it's pretty standard in most larger companies, or even medium-sized companies now, is like giving a career path for folks that isn't into management, right? You can be a senior software engineer, and then it's like, well, where do you go from there? What are your options? And try to avoid this old pathology that the generation ago companies led to. Whereas like, if you want to go past senior software engineer and you want to move in your career, you need to become a people manager, which you might not like or be good at, but that's what you kind of have to do. And so what there is now this model, and this generally copied across most of the industry, where you now have kind of three options. One is that once you get to the point where you're a senior software engineer, or maybe you're describing now in some works, intermediate is this level, is like you could just stop, right? Like you can keep doing a good job and have good performance, but you don't like have to keep getting promoted in order to stay on, which is maybe sounds obvious. Like, of course you don't have to keep getting promoted, but that's not true if you're like an intern, right? Like if you get brought in as an intern or a junior engineer, and like maybe this isn't totally obvious to people who are early in their career. I think most of our audience is like in leadership path or track at least. But if you come in as a junior engineer and then you just stay as a junior engineer, you're not really growing, you're not getting any better, like you're eventually going to be asked to kind of like ship up or shape out at some point. And so, and that's true up until you get to what in any given org, what they would call, or in any ladder, the terminal level, meaning like you can optionally stay here, and that's okay. Like, you've gotten to a level of seniority where you're not necessarily, in order to continue in your career, like, to stay employed here, you don't have to move up to principal engineer in order to stay. You could stay as a senior engineer, and that's great if that's the level of work that you want to do.
Well, what I see a lot of people in the industry get struggle with is this idea of, I was told I had a great performance reviews, or maybe I exceeded expectations. That means I'm ready for a promotion, right? And it turns out the answer is no, because it depends, of course, on the company and the amount of job levels they have and how rigorously they're defined. But at the companies where there's kind of a fixed ladder, the expectations of each role are so different that you almost have to, it's almost like a different job at each level. And, you know, exceeding expectations at one level does not mean that you're ready for the next one. It's entirely a different job. Now, if you want that different job, great. And you should talk to your manager, and they probably will offer you the opportunity to start trying it. And then kind of then they get you promoted to that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that just because, for example, you are the world's best coder, that means now you're going to be, you know, the next level up of engineer at any random company. And that's always difficult, I think, especially for folks in our industry who, you know, generally are kind of more INTJ kind of focused on, like, okay, what are the milestones? Give me a checklist. I will meet the checklist, and then I have done a good job. Yes, and you will give me a new title and more money. It's like, well, yeah, that's how it maybe should work, but it doesn't always, it doesn't usually, I think.
That's probably more true for like junior engineer roles. Like most of the time, most managers get pretty good at helping steer junior engineers into how do you become an intermediate engineer, because that is like the success path. If that's not happening, then there's something wrong. Like your organization, the reason you hire junior engineers is not to have junior engineers, is to turn them into strong intermediate engineers, right? And so most of the time, if you're exceeding expectations as a junior engineer, in most orgs, you're probably tracking towards getting promoted to intermediate engineer. Where it starts to come fuzzy is when you're a senior engineer, and like you're describing, I'd be interested actually for your recap, or at least from memory of how AWS sort of describes this difference. But most orgs, once you get past senior engineer, have a fairly different way of describing what does success look like for a staff plus level. And your senior engineer might be like, you write really lots of really high quality code, and then so you really exceeded the expectations of how much high quality code you would write. And like you were sort of alluding to, that staff level, it might be like, or a principal level, it might be like, you leveled up the code that entirely other parts of the organization maybe you're writing, or things like that. So I don't know, how does that work at AWS? What are the sort of things that the organization looks for? I mean, you've gone through this path and long enough ago that I assume you're also involved in some of the decision-making in helping other people move up this path. What are the key differences in what that track looks like when you get into that staff plus principal level?
It's definitely a part of my job to help others kind of level up. You know, one of my mentors in the past said that the best output of senior engineers is more senior engineers. You bring people up to the level, and that's the best way to kind of force magnify. And I feel the same way with the people that I work with, right? You know, to some degree, I try to mostly work with people at my level or above, or if I'm talking about people below my level, I'm trying to kind of share what the people above my level are sharing with me and kind of magnify, and then also then to get them autonomous and bring them into those meetings and bring those discussions and start thinking about the way that, you know, get that level. The AWS approach to this is hard to quantify, because one of the things that has kept me at Amazon for 10 years is that very rarely has anyone concretely defined to me what my job description was. You know, obviously I knew what products I was working on, and I knew that, you know, broadly speaking, that we had customers and they had needs and we were working on those. And so, you know, that ultimately becomes requirements, and that becomes software lines of code and things like that. But the exact spot where my participation or my role kind of started and where it ended was always very fuzzy. When I came to Amazon, I came from a company that had, you know, QA and had, ops engineers that would, you know, deploy SOC code to production. And, you know, I suddenly joined Amazon and I was on a team that didn't have any of those. And every engineer was responsible for designing, developing, testing, and releasing to production all their software. And, you know, that's sort of become more and more common, I think, in our industry now. And like, you know, you hear about kind of the DevOps or platform engineering, all those, there's a lot of buzzwords around it. But ultimately, it means that, you know, there's a perception, I think it's become more ubiquitous, although maybe somebody is challenging it these days. It's always hard to tell, that the people writing business logic code should also be the same people that understand how it's deployed to production. even if their decision of how it gets deployed to production is, I'm going to delegate this to a managed service of some sort of operations to the cloud, right? You understand the constraints and limitations of your dependencies, and you're not just, you know, writing code that input, you know, receives one object, outputs another one. Similar on the role level itself, like, you know, developers in much of the industry, maybe, or some of the industry, or definitely, I feel like when I came out of university in the early 2000s, the feeling was, you know, developers receive requirements and they output code for QA for testing. And that was sort of like the pipeline, right? And what I found is that as my own career kind of progressed and my seniority grew, my own involvement in software became earlier and earlier. Like on the career ladder, it talks about, for example, that like intermediate engineers take well-defined requirements, but maybe the architecture isn't defined, and they define the architecture and then they implement it. And then CNG engineers, take maybe kind of undefined, business problems that exist and come up with technical solutions for them, right? And then beyond that, you're talking about business problems that you're identifying business problems that maybe nobody's even asking for, right? And maybe the customers are not even asking for yet. And you're coming to customers saying, hey, what would you say about blah? You know, would that make your life easier? And if they say yes, then you're like, okay, let's talk more. Let's figure out what that looks like and then come up, work with product managers and identify what that solution looks like.
So what does that relationship then look like, at least in your org? Because like we can't, Amazon has literally 1 million employees. Like you can't speak of all of Amazon, right? Or at least for like the parts of AWS, which I understand you're in like the serverless. Is it actually, I'll pop up one level. And it's like, is AWS organized into like units? Like it's, I assume it's not just like there's the 150 different icons on the dashboard console. And so there's 150 unrelated teams. Like there's some sort of structure to it.
Definitely. So, okay, I can walk you up the chain. So my primary, my job is I'm one of the two principal engineers on the AWS service called EventBridge, which used to be called CloudWatch Events. And it's our event bus service. You know, probably most people listening are familiar with event buses. AWS has one. There's also queuing services that are one-to-one and, topic services that are one-to-many, and event buses are many-to-many. That's ours. And our kind of a nearest neighbor is we have an org called Events and Workflows. And our nearest neighbor in that org is a service called Step Functions, which is our AWS orchestration service. And, EventBridge is sort of, with event buses, you can create pretty advanced choreography-based architectures in the cloud. And with Step Functions, you can create workflow services. And so, choreography and orchestration kind of go hand to hand. So we have an org around that. And then there's a few peripherally related to that as well. There's another service called Simple Workflow, which is actually AWS's original workflow service that I actually, ironically, originally applied for. But during the interview, they're like, actually, you're going to work on a different team. And I was like, okay, that happened a lot 10 years ago, I think. And so, yeah, we have this, workflow and events and kind of all these services. We have also have scheduling in this org. So we have like a serverless scheduler. And that's about, I would say about 200 people is like across these two, there's probably five or six services, including our managed Apache Airflow service and an internal service called the Distributed Job Scheduler, which also does like kind of fancy both scheduling and orchestration stuff. And then that exists inside a larger org, which we used to be a part of serverless with Lambda and API Gateway, kind of all those services that people typically gravitate to when they first hear the word serverless.
Yeah.
And now we're also kind of nearest neighbors is also the containers orgs as well, like the Elastic Container Service and the Kubernetes service. And there, at this point now you can see the affinity starts to diverge a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot of common elements, right? Especially in my service, what I really love about where I work on right now is that EventBridge, kind of it's in the name, is a bridge service. Like it's there to integrate other AWS services. So I talk to customers that use a lot of AWS and they are comfortable with like using the right tool for the job and they want the integration to be smooth and seamless and as easy as possible. And we help with that. But sometimes we integrate with AWS services whose customers only use that service and they use nothing else. And there's actually tension between the fact of what those customers that use a lot of AWS and a lot of services want versus customers that really just want, let's say, AWS to orchestrate some of their container deployments and basically nothing else. And that comes up with some interesting challenges between how do you build something that works for both? Because a lot of times you just can't. They just have conflicting needs. AWS is too big. And you know, you can optimize for the largest customers, you know, the enterprise customers that, you know, maybe spend many millions of dollars on the cloud versus the long tail of individual developers. There might be 100 times more of them, but, you know, you only make $1 a month though, from each of those people. And so the things that they need is something different.
I've seen that evolution in kind of firsthand or secondhand, I guess, as a, like a small company, for supporting a small company, and we have needs and we'll go in and we'll try like, oh, let's configure this thing on like the AWS IAM portal, which is like their thing for like authentication and permissions. And it's like, this is 100 times more complicated than it needs to be for what we're trying to do. Like, why is that? Right. Like, and then you're like, it's like an entire DSL for describing this stuff. And we're just like, I just want like, we have three users and like, what is going on? And it's because of exactly what you describe. It's just like, yeah, you know, there's a whole bunch of people that just want three things, but then like General Electric has like whatever, tens of thousands of people that all have different needs and things like that. And so
you've probably seen that curve of like, you know, like where you're like, you like, as you gain knowledge and you feel like you're an expert and then you come to a certain threshold and you start dripping where your confidence suddenly plummets.
You feel like you know less. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that actually, I had that sudden collapse in my own confidence only recently because I actually set out to become an identity and access management that I am expert kind of last year. I mean, expert insofar as, you know, for what I need to not to do my job, you know, in context. And it made me realize just how much inconsistency and backwards compatibility issues exist. It's a sort of a microcosm of the Microsoft problem, you know, where Windows has all these like solutions to make sure the customer workloads keep running. We have the same in AWS. Like, we are very, very vigilant about not breaking backwards compatibility. And that means that there's often times when you want to introduce something that makes perfect sense and feels like not a breaking change. But some very smart people that I now talk to regularly kind of will explain to you just exactly why certain customers will have a heart attack if you ever try to do something like this, because it breaks all their mental models and integrations. And it's an interesting challenge about how to still ship anything knowing that this exists out there.
Well, and that's one of the, I remember I've had a few times arguments with people with years, like, why does AWS, they're nuts, always making all these new services. There's like 10 new services every year announced, like, or probably way more than 10 new ones now. And some of them are like, okay, there's AI now, and so we want to explore what we can do for AI or whatever. But some of it is like, okay, well, we have this legacy thing that is super flexible and can serve 10,000 different needs, and it's a huge octopus with a whole bunch of backwards compatibility. But some people have just a subset of those needs. And so like trying to, in some ways, be competitive, or tell me if I'm off base on this, but this is the sense I get from the outside, trying to be competitive enough to try and maybe serve some of those simpler needs in ways that don't have to have all of the sort of Cthulhu level of complexity underneath the surface, to give some competition to, or like some answer to, the ever-growing industry of companies that kind of just like take, you know, like Heroku is like an age-old version of this. Mm-hmm. It's just like, take AWS and create a nice, simple UI for people who have a simpler problem and don't necessarily want to learn all the depth of IAM and Event Bridge and all these sort of things.
That's definitely part of it. I mean, there's definitely a subset of services that are like that. Like Lightsail is one like that. And it's definitely a few services that, you know, you can think of as, you know, kind of going up the abstraction stack, right, and remove complexity and kind of have sensible defaults that make sense. I would say the majority are not those. We're typically always very careful to find ways to introduce the simplification to the underlying service. It's not always possible. You know, there's a lot of and if you're familiar with this, the concept of Cloud Development Kit, which is a client-side solution for generating infrastructure as code. Mm-hmm. And it's can do there's a lot of really nice things on the client side, and before it outputs the CloudFormation, which is ultimately the kind of the, you know, the languages of the AWS cloud with, you know, the infrastructure, the declarative infrastructure definition. And it's somewhat controversial because you can be extremely efficient in it, but people wish that those efficiencies actually existed on the server side rather than being inside your client kind of generated infrastructure. And I totally sympathize with those folk that want that. It's not always possible. I will say, though, that the majority of services and products that AWS builds, all of them are always based on a specific customer need. And, you know, some customer says, I want to be able to do this. I don't have a way to do that. Sometimes those things are what you said, like, I just, you know, I don't want it to be simpler. But a lot of times it actually does something unique and people realize, oh, it doesn't fit into any existing services. Let's build a new one. But what happens is when you introduce that, as soon as you release things and people start using your software in a, you know, in production, you kind of, it's a little bit like the death of the author thing with novels and interpretation. You kind of lose the, you know, your original intent for what it was built and designed for.
And then it's what people use it, how they use it.
It's how they use it. And so when they come to you the next and say, can you build blah? And you say, well, you know, that feature does make sense, but it doesn't really belong in this product. You should use this other product instead, which already does that. And they say, no, I don't want to use that.
I want to use your product.
I'm already using it. Why can't you just do it for me? And we hem and haw and we talk about migrations and we talk about, you know, portability. But ultimately, at some point, if enough customers ask for it, it's going to get built and it's going to get used. And that's then dilutes the very crisp kind of product delineation between like this service is for this and this service is for this. But the customer is kind of right. It makes them life harder, of course, for new customers coming on, right? If they're trying to learn, you know, and you can tell them, oh, we have these purpose-built features, right? Like databases for different use cases or application integration services for, you know, queues and streams and topics and buses. But when you start looking closer at the details, you realize, well, wait a second, why can, you know, this service do blah that really makes sense for all of them, but the other ones don't do it? And the answer is, well, their customers were more needy and more pushy and they asked for it. And
or maybe more, there was more of them, right? I mean, that's one of the things
maybe
that's
more,
hard.
Absolutely, yeah.
When you're looking at, and I'm sure you're even more familiar with this than I am being on the inside of it, but when you're a customer and you're looking at, okay, there's 999 different services that AWS offers, and it looks like at least three of them might address this problem that we have. One of the things you're trying to do, and like you're Googling and having other people's like, or talking to other people who build on AWS to try to build your mental model, it's like, of course, the docs say, this service is great and it can solve this problem. But you also want to know, like, is this a popular service? Is this some other, are other people trying to do what I'm trying to do? Because I'm trying to do X. And like, it looks like other people are doing things, but if they're all trying to do Y, I'll be the only person that's like putting in a support message. And of course, I'm the small fry on this startup being like, hey, can you add support for whatever? And it'll be in the bottom of the pile. Whereas if it's like something that everybody's using, especially if a lot of people are using for the same thing as me, then I'm way more likely to be swimming with the tide.
That's a legitimate problem. I do think that we're trying to get better at it, and some things that my service, EventBridge, tries to really internalize and help people with. Like, we recently had reInvent launch this thing called Pipes, which is a way to connect existing AWS event sources to AWS targets. And it was very much like in this mental model of like, you know, you should be able to have a common tool that you can use whenever you're trying to just like consume events from, let's say, SQS or Kinesis or any source, you want to send it somewhere, you should be able to reach for this like generic thing. It won't be solve all your problems, but it's a good starting point for most problems, right? But the kind of tie back to something you asked earlier, like the reason this happens is, you know, a lot of people will criticize AWS for this. I think it's legitimate, right? That there's like so much inconsistency and, you know, so many services, but it's very much a kind of a feature of the intentional bottoms up organizational design where each of those teams have a lot of autonomy. You know, each of these services is its own standalone business. They have a general manager who kind of, you know, owns the profit and loss of, you know, of what they, you know, what they try to do. And of course, obviously, we're a huge behemoth as well. And we have, you know, central marketing teams and all that other stuff. But ultimately, you know, there's very, very little top-down forced guidance of what you have to build. There's like a small list of every service must launch with blah. And, you know, that small list has definitely grown over the years. And it's, you know, but it probably still, if somebody saw the internal list of like what is mandatory requirements for new service launches, it's still probably much smaller than people realize. And there's still so much autonomy for each individual team to make decisions on what they believe is the best for this domain, this context, their customers. And, you know, what's attractive about that is that typically that process of being deeply connected to the customers that are trying to ask for it means that every time we build something, it tends to get, you know, pretty fast adoption, which for me is extremely addicting. Like my last three, maybe four projects before I came to Amazon over the last like 3-4 years in the industry were like, you know, projects of almost a whole year that either got canceled close to launch or launched and then went nowhere. And I found that very dissatisfying, like writing code that no one would then run and use. And I haven't had that problem since I came to Amazon. And that's been very, very rewarding for me. And I hope others too that work on this stuff, because I think what's the point of doing anything if it doesn't have an impact, right? Like you're doing it for a purpose, right? And the output isn't the code. The output is the problem solving you're giving to somebody.
Yeah, that customer orientation goes back to like it's kind of one of the famous things they'll tell in the lore about Amazon as a company is a customer obsession. And you hear often about that in the retail side of the business, which, as I understand, is very separate from the AWS stuff. But it's interesting to me to what degree that the org structure of AWS has been set up for success at the product per product level. Obviously, it has, as we were talking about, it has some weird side effects in terms of the overall strategy of all AWS. You end up with like the old way that the console used to be, that you open it up and there's 999 icons, right? But right. And so it has some trade-offs, but that you end up with this tight loop where you're talking to customers and like, and I say you've not just your org, but like Nick is talking to customers on a regular basis. I don't know like how many times a month or whatever, or a week, or how you quantify how often you're talking to customers, but it sounds like you're regularly doing it. Mm-hmm. And then that's driving this feature. Obviously there's a bit of a dynamic where you're trying to balance between, you have this one really big customer that's like a bit of a whale and you're like, I definitely want to serve them. But then also you're presumably, or I don't know, maybe describing a little detail, you're having folks either on the product management side, or maybe you're doing this synthesizing. We also have all these smaller users, and like what in aggregate, what are their needs?
Absolutely. And I mean, the answer to the question of how often is feast and famine, right? It's like kind of like the rest of the role, right? There are different parts of the year depending on what's going on. If there's a new project and we're trying to find, you know, get clarity on it, I might be talking to customers multiple times a week, you know, multiple times a day, trying to kind of get clear to answer on some specific differentiator. And then, you know, there'll be gaps. Well, I'm just, you know, just working heads down with the team on something, and then, you know, maybe getting feedback again near launch. So you mentioned the whales versus the small customers. So when my service EventBridge launched, it was launched as CloudWatch Events. And CloudWatch is AWS's kind of observability service, right? It's got metrics and logs and events, right? And so these are things happening in your account that you're observing. And so when it was launched like that, it was a really good way to demonstrate the value of event buses. Like, you have an event bus, and whether you do anything or not there, AWS is publishing events into your event bus about everything going on everywhere else, right? And you can choose to match those events and do something about them and then call out AWS services. So, you know, when that's happening, these things are happening in your account, whether you do anything about them or not, it sort of made sense that these should be free, right? And so even to this day, I don't know what public numbers I'm allowed to speak about, but the majority of the stuff that happens inside of EventBridge is free because it's AWS events, and you, somebody's matching them, send them to AWS. So, you know, we do, I can probably say we do millions of, you know, events per second that we receive across all of AWS, and most of that we don't charge for. Customers that love that and they're happy with it. And there's the customers that actually build, you know, full, let's say, you know, organizational event buses and have, you know, dozens of teams where they're all publishing events to that bus. And then a dozen other teams are receiving those events. And that obviously now, you know, we do charge for that, but these are kind of your own custom events. But the majority of traffic is AWS itself.
Yeah, that's an interesting like bootstrapping approach, I guess. And that's one of the things, like once you get to AWS scale, that you can sort of find opportunities like that. Like, okay, we have this new service and it can process events. Like, we're just going to wire it up with a bunch of events that you might find useful, so that you don't just have an empty dashboard.
Right. It also is an interesting challenge in terms of scaling, right? And like we, you know, we, like I said, we have millions of events that happen across all AWS accounts.
Per second.
Per second. That's pretty inefficient, right? To accept all that. And then if somebody's matching them, then, you know, just get to drop them. So we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we can go upstream to the hundreds of AWS services that publish us events and, you know, reduce the amount of work that is being done throughout, which of course, you know, kind of bucks against certain, let's say, best practice conventions for these things. Typically, you know, you want to do, for example, typically if you're going to do, you know, let's say, caching, you try to do that on the server side and not push things to the client, because that has its own risks of, you know, drift and just all sorts of problems. But we have to, because otherwise we're going to be handling a gigantic amount of traffic and then not doing anything with it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But it's interesting to me, like, these are organizational boundary things that people don't think of. Like, people think of AWS as if it's like this monolithic thing where it's like very, very much not, which, I mean, it makes sense, but you can't build an org that size monolithically.
Yeah. A lot of AWS services that people use and might not realize, it's probably like, well, okay, certainly not the biggest ones that people, of course, recognize, but if for example, AWS launches a new service and you see an announcement, that's probably one team, like team of about 10 people. That's it, you know, that owns the whole thing, console, you know, the server side, all the, you know, integrations with the client side tooling, which is why it's always some funny for me. And I get a little bit defensive. So, you know, there's a couple of folks on the internet who kind of maybe less so these days, but there was definitely a peak when there was a lot of snark online of kind of tearing down new service launches. And I was like, I get it. AWS is a huge $1 trillion, you know, Amazon $1 trillion company. People think they're punching up. But what ends up happening is that like four junior engineers who worked on like that feature are super upset because some dude with a huge Twitter following is dunking on what he believes is a $1 trillion company, but really like four junior engineers in a room or 10 for the whole thing. But yeah.
And that's one of those things that you work in big tech or work with people who do work in big tech and you build way more empathy, I think, that it's a whole bunch of individual people all trying to do well and not just like Apple is just a sphere that just makes decisions and commutes them into the world.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I'm not getting any sympathy for it. I'm certainly not asking for it, but it is interesting to always remember that in a general sense. I'm guilty of the same thing whenever I think of others.
I mean, it's also good to still keep a critical eye. Just try to be a little bit kind about it. Before we run out of time, I want to loop back to this where we started the conversation because I think it's super value to people thinking about career paths, right? This is especially in 2023, there's a lot of people who are at crossroads either because they're seeing some of the changes happening in the industry. There's a lot of companies that are growing. There's a lot of companies that are shrinking. And people are thinking like, okay, I'm in a leadership path in terms of my career, but how do I think about either on my teams or on my own career path, this path of how we're orienting to managerial roles versus these like staff and principal engineer roles. So I'd be interested, I mean, lots of questions I could ask on that, but on your take on this thing we were talking a little bit before the recording started on this idea of staff archetypes or principal engineer archetypes. And this is something, there's a website, staffeng.com, which I can link in the show notes that people may have seen before, where if somebody has gone and done a bunch of research trying to build an understanding of like, okay, what does staff plus engineering role look like across different organizations? And what are some of the common themes? And they sort of built this idea of archetypes. You know, most junior engineers, maybe most orgs have like relatively similar set of responsibilities and expectations. But once you get up to the like staff principal levels, your job could be a totally unrelated job to someone else's, where there's almost no overlap of what you do.
Even within the same company, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking to customers constantly. There's probably other principal engineers at Amazon, or maybe not at Amazon, but certainly at some companies where, like, certainly at Apple, I'm sure there's lots of principal engineers that don't talk to customers, right? I'd be curious on your take on to what degree you empathize or within your role and within the org of these archetypes, which I'll just kind of list out the way that they describe them. They describe there's the idea of a tech lead, which is sort of this staff-less role where they're basically empowering a team. So there's a team, and then your job is to just like make sure that that team is doing well, you know, executing well. There's the architect, which has like a larger area that there's a whole bunch of teams. They have responsibility for, you know, direction, quality, and approach within some technical area. There's the solver that kind of goes around and comes into like wherever there's a fire and they like help put out that fire or solve a really tricky problem. They're the sort of person that, you know, might get pulled in where it's like, oh, we have this 1% of launches are crashing and we just can't reproduce it and we have no logs. Like we could have solved the solver problem. And then the last one they had was like the right hand, which is the idea of like, there's an executive who is trying to execute across a wide area. And then you pair them up with a principal engineer that can go in and solve problems specifically that is in the sort of purview of that executive, which may be in any of those three categories. So I'm curious, like, A, does that resonate with what you have seen? And B, like, you know, do you see yourself in any of those categories?
It does. It definitely resonates. Of course, you know, they say any senior or staff or principal engineer's favorite phrase is, it depends.
Yeah.
And this is very much one of those, right? It depends on kind of the time of year and the project. We actually do have a principal roles framework inside Amazon, inside AWS for sure, that was first popularized by S3, which is kind of, you know, the oldest AWS service and probably the biggest and probably the most well-known, you know, with its 11.9 durability. And so, you know, there's probably no one person that knows how the whole thing works, right? And so
I'm just going to say that again because it's a known thing that people talk about, but 11.9's reliability. And then sometimes you'll hear that and it just like washes over you. It's like, what does that actually mean? It's like 99.9 and then 9 more nines.
It's an insane amount of durability, but ultimately it also is like at the scale of the service, it also means that, like, you know, it also means that basically in theory, data is lost every single day.
At that scale.
And so the way that they have published they discussed it, and I think the leader of the team might have even done a reInvent talk about it, is that, yeah, you have roles on different projects, and there's roles like guide or sponsor or catalyst. And they sort of vaguely come up to some of what you're talking about here. And so I think the reality of the role is that you're almost never going to be, again, there's a threshold, right? Depending on where those levels line up for different teams, right? I've been a tech lead, I've been an architect, I've been a solver. And at this point now, I would say I go gravitate between these depending on the project that I'm on. I've also, I guess, been a right hand, I would say, probably, although not for as long of a period. And yeah, I mean, it's a cop-out, but the reality is that this kind of depends on the needs of the organization, right? You know, and the needs of your customers. And of course, your personal interests, because you don't get to this level of seniority without having some agency over your responsibility. If the organization is asking something of you that does not align with your interests, values, you're probably not going to be super successful at it, right? For me, how I measure kind of my motivation is less in terms of like specific output, but more in terms of impact. And the best way I can have a large impact kind of depends on the project and the situation. Sometimes it might mean just sitting down with a team and saying, hey, we have this problem. Let's work together and let me try to help you, you know, debug it. Sometimes it's sitting down with an architectural design document saying, you know, I think you have a lot of ambiguity here, but I think we should go forward with this. Even though there's a certain amount of risk, let's start it, let's prototype it. I'm taking on kind of the responsibility, the decision to go forward despite the ambiguity, and kind of I'll own the repercussions if we're wrong, but ultimately I think this is the right path. Let's get going with it. Sometimes it might mean talking to a senior manager or senior leader, even a director or above, and kind of convincing them of a certain path, or, you know, sitting down with two of them and saying, hey, look, we have this problem. We have this inconsistency or this lack of alignment of mental models that exists between these two teams. Let me write a document that explains it. And, you know, let's both review it so we're all on the same page. And then that kind of can disseminate through the two different organizations. And that might not be even that, you know, that'll start from technical perspectives, but ultimately you're trying to influence, you know, high level leaders, because then they will, you know, affect their roadmaps and their prioritization. It kind of depends on what's the most impactful thing you can do and where the complexity lies, right? Sometimes it's a question of ambiguity at the technical level. Sometimes it's ambiguity at product level. There's almost always something to do with ambiguity. Like there's
that's one of the things as you move through your career, I think a lot of people, most people realize this explicitly, although some people just kind of know it without really having thought about it explicitly, is that one of the biggest inputs to like how far are you on your career or like how far are you on this ladder in terms of seniority, principal, whether it's principal engineer or you're a senior manager or director or whatever, is how ambiguous your job is in terms of like, what are you even supposed to be doing? How are you even spending your time? What even is impact, and what output should you be pushing for is less and less clear as you move up. Sort of not quite by definition, but certainly by a strong correlation.
Everyone probably knows that when they start a new job, there's a lot of confusion, but then the goal at that point is like disambiguate that and then figure out how to do it. And what I've found is attractive for myself is always to kind of be at the edge of that, is to go to the next thing. As soon as I get good at anything, I start finding it boring. It's probably not a healthy trait.
Wow. It has pros and cons. I have some empathy with that mindset, for better or for worse. But I think you hit on something there that I think is a really valuable sort of leadership skill, which is this, you didn't phrase it this way, but this like being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yes.
And there's a certain habit that most people earlier in their career have. And some people, you know, being uncomfortable and working with ambiguity is not for everyone, right? Like it's not necessarily pleasant, right? Even when you are comfortable with it, or it's what you sort of the way that you like to work. And so when we talk about back to this thing of the terminal level, and like you get to maybe you're a senior engineer and you're working on problems that are, you know, there's some ambiguity necessarily, but it's not like you're going off and like talking to customers every day about like what would they even want, and totally brainstorming or dealing with 10 different teams that all disagree with each other. Like maybe you're actually like taking tickets from a bug tracking system and fixing them. There's so much value in having folks in the team that will move towards where there's ambiguity, that will see this thing is not well defined, and this there's struggles happening, and it seems to be because these two people don't have a shared mental model of how this works, or there doesn't seem to be agreement on what success would even look like, or it's not clear whether or not we even can move the needle on this thing, or whatever, those kind of things. And people whose attention drifts towards that are way more likely to have an impact than the people who see, oh, well, it looks like there's a mess over there, so I'm just going to avoid it and try to pretend it's not there. You know, which is what you want your junior folks to do. But
yeah, I think that there's a certain, at some point you realize that there's just a class of problems that just don't have standard well-defined solutions, let's say, right? There's just everything's a trade-off and you're trying to find a compromise, right, between different conflicting needs. And some compromises work, even if nobody's happy, you know, that infamous compromise. And other times there just isn't a compromise. You have to pick a decision. You have to pick one and not the other and accept the trade-offs. And I know I'm being vague, but that's sort of like, I think a lot of life is like that, isn't it? It's not just our industry. It's not just our jobs. It's, you know, it's humanity, actually, right?
Being a human being, ambiguous things, where it's not clear what the right thing to do is, but we try to pick one that's as good as we can. And
I mean, I do think about these things as I get older, you know, about how humanity has gotten this far in terms of how we developed anything, really, you know, technological progress, societal progress. And, you know, when you're in the microcosm of seeing how the sausage is made of, you know, any progress, now it's, you know, about AI or, you know, political advancements or progressive advancements. Like, it's kind of a miracle that we got this far to begin with. Pretty humbling to think about that it's just done by people like us.
Yeah, it's a whole bunch. Well, that's the humbling thing and almost disturbing thing, I think, of the first time someone works in a big company like Amazon or Apple. He's like, oh, it's just a bunch of people just trying to do stuff. Like, I thought there was some magic here that you would get in and you would be given, like, oh, no, here's the way to make perfect decisions and make sure that we have just a way better system for everything than anywhere else has. It's like, no, it's just a bunch of people trying.
I'll tell you a little anecdote. When I was first promoted, I got access to the principal engineer Slack room. It just so happened, obviously, you know, you're newly promoted, you have a ton of imposter syndrome about it.
Yes.
And it just so happened that week, there was already a discussion about imposter syndrome. One of the people that commented about their imposter syndrome was James Gosling, who's a distinguished engineer at Amazon and a creator of Java, was freely talking about their imposter syndrome and the things that they struggle with. And that was pretty eye-opening for me.
Did that make you feel more or less like an imposter? If you were like, well, I guess maybe we're all on the same footing, or did that make you feel like, oh man, if he doesn't feel like he belongs here, then I really don't belong here?
I have just enough confidence that it was the first one. I maybe realized that it doesn't necessarily have to be associated with any reason. And I was able to kind of ignore the second voice that was saying the second thing.
Well, that's probably for the best. What's been awesome chatting. I think that folks will find it useful thinking about some of these paths and how these roles can come together. Is there anywhere people can go to find you online or read or follow your work?
Not really. I'm trying to quit Twitter right now, so I'm not going to direct people there. I am on Blue Sky, but it's, you know, still a close community. So at one point I might set up a little, I do have a vanity domain name, but there's nothing on there right now, so I won't share it. But yeah, definitely, you know, if you're curious about the work that I do, just check out EventBridge or, you know, the whole, like, that area of AWS, EventBridge, pipes, buses, schedules. It's all good stuff. I'm pretty proud of it. I've been working for the last few years.
Awesome. Thanks, Nick. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Alan.
It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. And that's it for today. You can give us feedback. You can rate the show by going to itshipped.fm, or you can give us feedback on Twitter or on Mastodon. And until next time, keep shipping.